sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
M&A activity is booming. Markets break their weekly losing streak, inflation heating up, and our guest today is Das, back by popular request. All this and much more on episode number 481 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz and I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today and each and every week on about Sunday afternoon, sometime between, well, sometimes it's early we put this out, but usually towards the end of the night where we're getting ready and prepared for the week to come, setting up some of our idea lists, looking at our watch lists, looking at what's happening with the futures around the world, also digesting all of the interesting news stories that go on related to finance and markets throughout the week. And there's a lot of things that have been going on. Yeah, we started off with the topic, hey, you know what? M&A. M&A is definitely booming. We saw that there was some rumors, some comments, some noise about the potential for a takeover by Time Warner, by AT&T. And over the weekend, that seemed to have panned out and played out pretty well, where there is going to be at least the attempt by AT&T to take over Time Warner in an effort to build up their media and their distribution and, well, their competition potential, because some of the other firms that they compete with have done the same thing recently. The problem is that they're doing it at a very bad time. What I mean by that is they're doing it in the heart of probably one of the craziest political seasons that we've seen in a while, and that's going to invite scrutiny. Already we've seen that Donald Trump has come out with his commentary about why he thinks this shouldn't go through. And we've seen other various politicians come out with their commentary that there could be some additional scrutiny on this because it will create too much of a, I guess what they're thinking is a monopoly, or at least too much of a power condition where there could be the potential, I suppose, that they could have too much of a overall ability to charge us what they want, to limit us on certain services, etc. So we're going to probably see a lot of things over the next week, a lot of comments, a lot of discussion about where this may have some antitrust issues that are built into this particular merger. But we're seeing some continued interest from the rumor mill. As I had, I think I mentioned this before, that while everybody seems to be out of this Twitter deal, well, we got to just wait for maybe China or Asia or some other country and to have rumors of them. And SoftBank is now the latest name that's coming into the discussion about maybe looking into a Twitter buyout. But we'll see how that goes. The main things that really have been playing out in the market over the last week are the same things that we've seen time and time again over the last several months. Markets are stuck in a consolidation range. There are couple of weeks down, couple of weeks up, moving towards the highs, breaking down close to the lows. We saw that move to the 100-day moving average on the S&P 500, then a bounce up. Then we saw the 100 and the 150-day both being very supportive. And that's a very interesting thing because we're seeing that the markets are playing very technically right now in the face of all the things that potentially could either push them up or push them down. So we do see that the 50-day moving average has been and will be resistance for some time on the upside. On the downside, we have the 100-day moving average as well as the 150-day moving average. Now, before we get to our guest today, I want to mention a few things. We did see that inflation started to move a bit higher. As a matter of fact, we saw that the most recent reading that was released last week on consumer prices was up 1.5% for the 12 months ending in September. And this is the highest annualized inflation rate since October of 2014, which shows you why tips are doing so well. Tips right now, if you have that ETF or maybe a mutual fund that owns tips, they're up an average of about 7% year to date, which is beating all the major market indices from an equity standpoint. And I think I mentioned tips some time ago that we had overweighted our portfolios for our clients in tips about a year ago. And we started to increase that position slowly but steadily because we thought that this was kind of the time that with negative interest rates as a backdrop and with central banks really pulling out all the stops in order to make sure that they keep the bond yields down as best as possible, there is the very likely potential that we're going to see an inflationary environment move higher. And we saw Janet Yellen talk about that as well, how she wants to keep the high-pressured economy moving. In other words, they're going to be accommodative for a lot longer than you expect, even with the fact that they're going to surpass their inflation targets. Now, one of the things that I thought was really interesting in this was that the headline CPI number that came out was a 0.3%. And if you annualize that on its own, if we continue at this pace, we're talking about a 3.6% inflation rate, which is significant. We also saw that existing home sales did, in fact, have a bit of a rebound. We saw that a 3.2% gain in resales, which was the first improvement since June. And first-time buyers made up about 34% of home purchases, which is a four-year peak, which is nice to see. Now, the Census Bureau reported a 9% plunge for groundbreaking, for getting things going. But building permits increased. So there's some back and forth movement in this. But generally speaking, the housing market is holding well. And also, I'll end with this before we get to our guest, is that oil continues to move higher. It's five consecutive weeks that oil has now rallied from the lows. And there's a big meeting coming up, and we'll see how that plays out with regard to OPEC. Already we're seeing some breakdown of their comments and on their production freeze and their output reductions, etc. So we'll have to keep an eye on that very closely to see what happens with oil, because the oil market is something that is helping to benefit those companies in the S&P that are related to that. And of course, that will help earnings overall. So anyway, we're also going to talk today about some of the earnings that are coming up next week. I'll give you a full list of those in a moment when we after we finish with our guest today, Das. So just stick around for that. And you know, I just had to make that call. I had to have him on because I got a couple of emails in from people saying, when is Das coming back on? We need him. We have to have him. We want him. So straight from down under, where it's early in the day, we have Das. And he is the author of many books, but the latest, The Age of Stagnation. So we welcome him. How are you, sir?
Good. And how are you?
I'm pretty good here. One of the things that you and I have talked about recently is this the whole notion of that four-letter word, and well, the other four-letter word, which is risk, which in a way used to be a four-letter word, you know, meaning bad and something negative and has negative connotation. But these days, you know, there's a sense, I think, at least on my side here, there's a general investors seem anesthetized to things. You know, back in the day, whenever that day was, there was this, you know, if something was going bad, whether it was an earnings issue, whether it was a political issue, whether it was a government or some kind of other global event, it lasted more than 2 days. You know, these days, as we know, Brexit lasted for a little while with uncertainty. Markets were upset for 2 or 3 days, and then that was it. But risk is a big issue. There's a lot of actual things that are out there these days, aren't there?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the interesting thing about risk is nobody notices it until it's run you over. And I think that's the major issue now going forward, because the things that can run you over are multiplying. And I think one of the key things is there are two general classes of risk, both of which you can't do a lot about. One is obviously policy, which is economic policy. And there's a lot of stuff going on in that space, which is very interesting. And the second, I think, is obviously rising political risk, which is very, very significant. And again, that's not something you can do a lot about. It just happens. And so let's have a look at the economic side of it. What I've noticed is in the last 6 months or so, the policymakers are becoming more and more strident. They keep saying, you know, they have additional measures could be deployed to revive growth and inflation. Every time I hear that, I remember a line in a book somewhere which said that on a ship, the beatings would continue until morale improved.
Right. You know, and they use the word scope. They use the word that we have scope. We have.
That's
we have,
right. But I think the funniest thing is it's you remember the Monty Python sketch where a limbless and wounded black knight is dying, refuses to concede defeat, threatening to bleed on the victor?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit like that. And if you look objectively, the options are very limited. I mean, monetary policy has pretty much run its course because I think people forget that it didn't actually work as well as people thought it would. It didn't actually increase spending to the extent that people had hoped for. And the real economy did not respond. I mean, the financial economy, we saw values go up. But basically, the real economy has not actually responded. And I think the limits are now very clear. For instance, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan are now finding it very difficult to continue because they can't actually buy securities to buy. And if they're going to go down this route of more negative interest rates, which is possible, then they're running into some very interesting political and social complications, like they're going to have to ban cash. Mm-hmm. And also what they're going to have to do is basically put capital controls, because if a country has negative interest rates and other countries have positive interest rates, well, why would you take all your money out and move it to the other country? So there's a lot of complications that have come in. And we've talked before about the effectiveness is not there, but also it's creating these asset price bubbles, which are problematic. And you can see this in a really roundabout way, all the discussion about fiscal stimulus. Now, the funniest thing about this discussion about fiscal stimulus is that if you actually look at the numbers, which obviously nobody bothers to do, mm-hmm. is everybody's running significant budget deficits already. And in some cases, they're running structural deficits, which means even if you don't take into account interest, they're running actual deficits. So actually, the fiscal stance in most countries, with the exception of the Germans, of course, is basically expansionary. And I hear over and over again that essentially, you know, fiscal policy is the magic bullet. But fiscal policy can only do one of two things. One is you can actually finance consumption. Well, then you need to do it every year to keep the economy growing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you finance infrastructure, which seems to be the major thing, I hear this all the time, you know, if interest rates are close to zero, well, you know, you basically can just finance infrastructure for nothing, and you can. But the fact that the cost of finance is close to zero is not necessarily a sufficient condition to justify that investment, because essentially what you're saying is the project, whatever it is worthwhile. And if that project doesn't give you the kind of returns that you're looking for, then obviously more and more of your capital gets tied up in unproductive investments. And so longer term, it actually detracts from growth. So I'm not really sure, despite there are some social benefits, obviously, of employing people and so forth from the government spending, whether it's the panacea. And what is really quite interesting is, I suppose, they come up with these scopes and new options. And I was sort of sitting down with a piece of paper and having a look at these options. And they look suspiciously to me like rebranded or repackaged mm-hmm. versions
right.
of existing policies.
Right.
I mean, Japan's got QQE, qualitative and quantitative expansion. And I said, well, how's that difference from QE plus forward guidance? And then, as you know, the Japanese have introduced YCC, yield curve controls, where they're going to actually manipulate the yield curve to try to offset the effect of negative rates on the banks. And I said, well, firstly, it reminds me a little bit of the Fed's twist. But, you know, and then there's helicopter money, which is obviously the government's essentially giving money to the taxpayers and the population funded by the central bank. And I'm going, isn't that what QE is at the moment? And so essentially what I see is there are initiatives, but they're not that different. And the funniest one is the one that the Fed came up with, or Fed Chairman Janet Yellen came up with in Boston, which is she believes in running a high-pressure economy.
That's the newest thing. That's the newest phraseology. A high-pressure economy. By the way, at that speech, there was a point in that discussion that it appeared to me that she conceded that monetary policy isn't going to be able to provide much more effectiveness. And if, in fact, there is any other kind of slowdown, there's not much more they can do. Did you hear that in that speech?
Yes, I did. And it was very, very carefully phrased to avoid everybody sort of jumping out the nearest window.
Right.
But basically, that's what she was saying. But if you also read about it, there's a lot of backside covering going on, because to me, high-pressure economy was just cover for delaying, or in fact, longer-term abandoning normalization of interest rates. That's what high-pressure economy actually
means. Right, it's just allowing for inflation rates, which it is, by the way, above the target. And now if they want to say, well, we didn't really mean the CPI, we meant the, another one, part of the GDP sub-factors, and that's the one we were really looking at. But the fact of the matter is that when you look at a high-pressure economy, it seems to me that, all they're talking about at this point is just allowing inflation to simply rise to a point beyond where it is, and as you said, delay.
Exactly. And so I think, and what's the problem with this is on the risk side is markets are nervous at the best of times. And they now sense that the policymakers have very limited options, and they also know that the policies can't be reversed. And what they're really concerned about is if suddenly the central bank position changes, whether it's an interest rate rise or the ECB not continuing its QE program patch marks next year, then under those circumstances, what will happen is there's going to be a major dislocation. And people actually miss something. In the last 3 months, I've been watching long-term bond rates, which have been moving very, very quickly in large quantums. And because if you look at the absolute levels of rates, particularly on long-dated securities, they're very sensitive now to interest rates. And in Japan, if you owned the 40-year bond, now not many people do that, but you would have lost 15% in a matter of a month, which is a serious chunk of change, no matter which way you look at it.
Yeah, but most of these investors right now, I think we have to talk about how the central banks have put it up. I mean, in Japan, in negative interest rates, and in Europe and other areas, but they structured this to try to tell people, listen, we're going to keep buying no matter what the case is. And by the way, one thing I think people don't really get the grasp of and what's going on in Europe is that the amount of QE that they're doing, which is about 80 plus or maybe $90 billion per month.
Yeah, it's about 90 billion because it's 80 billion euros.
That is much more than we did here, and we have in terms of the size of our bond pool.
It's much bigger.
And that's why it's pressed their bonds so low. I mean, their economy is no way at all in the shape of ours is. And, the bottom line is that their bonds are much lower. And I think what they're doing is they're creating Mario Draghi this week said, just we could all believe this, he doesn't see any bubbles at all. No bubbles for him. Okay?
A visit to his eye specialist might be in order.
Right. What's funny about that is that if you do not determine that bond prices and bond yields being negative are not a bubble and not normal, that's something that I think is you have to scratch your head over. You wondering, is he serious or is he just trying to placate the investor? I mean, what is he trying to do here? Because it's so obvious that that is a classic definition of what a bubble is.
But I think what you're pointing to is rather interesting, because these measures are now actually detracting from rather than restoring confidence. So you have official statements like the ones you mentioned from Mario Draghi saying, all is well, the bells have rung that, all is well at midnight. But every person in the real economy, business and households, are asking that if things are so good, why are all these measures required at all? If things are going along swimmingly, why aren't interest rates at 3%? Why isn't the government deficit much lower? And all of these sorts of things. And I think they're asking a question which is really important. If it's the kind of world where it necessitates government-sanctioned seizures of savings, which is what negative rates are, and central banks creating money and dropping it, they must be asking what kind of world will we be living in. And that's not going to be a world which creates certainty and optimism for the future. And I think that is a major problem now going forward.
But one of the
not
thing,
to mention,
yeah, but one of the things one of the things that we have is, let's take the stance for a second, and I'm talking about the U.S. for a moment. Let's take the stance that yes, the economy is in, I'm not saying great, let's say good shape. Okay, yeah, we have subpar GDP. I get that. Manufacturing looks okay. You know, we see that generally people are working. Housing formation is good. Generally speaking. There's really nothing wrong with our economy. It's not like it's on the brink.
It's ticking along.
It's not like on the, you know, all of a sudden you take
it's
a
not
left
about to collapse.
Right. And I agree with you that it's very odd that they are so nervous about, you know, because there's two ways to look at it. One way is, well, they're not telling us something. Something's not really right. And that's one area that you can have in the back of your head that, you know, there must be something serious going on or something that's not what's showing up here, which, by the way, they don't have anything that we don't have. All the data is out there. They publish all the data. So unless the data is falsified, that, you know, then who knows, but let's assume it's not. Then the fact is that, you know, things are going well. Then the second thing you have is the idea that, well, then they're petrified and paralyzed by the thought of raising rates because they have, first of all, most of them in their tenure have not really had the authority and the finger on the button, if you will, to do so. So by doing so, they don't want to go down in history as the person who raised rates.
Well, I think that's certainly true, but I think the reality is if you move up interest rates by about one percentage point in, say, the United States, if you have debt in the economy, which is roughly, say, 230% of GDP, that actually means that there's going to be a $3.8 trillion hit to income. Now, obviously, some of that will also show up on the other side as interest income, which will obviously help. But the question is, are the borrowers who actually have that debt, will they be able to service it? That's the question that everybody's asking.
And when you look at corporate debt in the U.S., the interesting thing, and we've talked about this on the show many times, it is higher today than it's ever been. It is lower yield, probably, than on the balance sheets, you know, on the debt side than it's been. But the debt service is also at a peak.
And I think the crucial thing here to remember is it's the debt's high. That's okay. But what they did with the debt, they used the debt to actually buy back shares and pay out dividends. So it wasn't as if they were creating new capacity, which is self-sustaining income sources, which will pay back that debt. So they basically increased the risk of the corporate capital structure. And that's what they've done.
It's musical chairs.
Yeah, and that's the danger. And I think the U.S. is still in a better place than everybody else, but it's like having a good house in a bad neighborhood, because the rest of the world has even worse position because the sustainability of the basic real economy is not the same, certainly not in Europe and certainly not in Japan. So I think it's the case. And then you have to layer on top of that the political mess, which is not going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
I'll leave the American election for you to discuss, as an outside watcher, I am rather sort of bemused, word I would say, about what's going on. But I think there's some other ones which perhaps people don't focus on. And let's start with Europe, which is always fun. I don't know whether you noticed, on the 2nd of October, the Hungarians held a referendum on immigration. Now, it's not going to count for anything because they had to get at least 50% of the voters to vote, and they didn't, only 40% vote. But a remarkable 98% of them voted against immigration. Now, usually you get 98% in a vote for, you know, election of dictators in tin pot countries. But what that shows you is that immigration issue in certainly certain members of the European Union is not going away. And that's going to become a major issue because the waves of immigration, because of the tragedy in the Middle East and also the problems economically and otherwise in North Africa, are going to continue. So that's not going to go away. But I think the trigger points are really interesting. The Austrians are having a rerun of their presidential election. And the guy who won is basically reasonably sensible, but he very closely beat a very far right wing anti-Euro, anti-immigration candidate. Now, the president in Austria is largely an honorific position, but if the far right-wing candidate was going to win, that would not augur well. But I think the crucial thing is Italy. Italy is always crucial. And
there are a lot of fun over there. I still want Berlusconi to get back there. He was a riot.
Yeah, I think Berlusconi certainly provided entertainment. And who knows, some of the American politicians may have learned something from Berlusconi. Have there been any bunga bunga parties in the U.S. election?
And no singing and putting out albums either.
No.
Not
sad,
yet.
Really, isn't it?
Yeah, terrible.
Sad. But the Italians have a referendum on some constitutional changes they want to do. And Matteo Renzi was riding very high, and he was basically very confident he'd get this through. So he basically said that if you don't put this through, then I'll resign, which is always unwise for a politician. And anyway, it looks like the polls have tightened quite a bit. And even members of Matteo Renzi's own party essentially now oppose it. And in effect, what this might do is set off a whole series of instability in Italian politics, which, if you think about it, is not uncommon.
Yeah.
But when you actually layer it on top of economic weakness, and particularly a banking system which is in serious trouble in Italy, that's not a good combination. But even if, the strange thing is, even if Matteo Renzi actually gets the constitutional changes through, there's actually a sting in the tail. And the sting in the tail, what he was trying to do is, in Italy, what happens is if basically the parliament votes for legislation, the upper house, the Senate as it were, can defeat it. And the Senate is completely non-representative, and he was trying to change that, which has some merits. But the problem is, if some other party comes in to power, then they automatically have the ability to push through any legislation without any checks and balances. And there's a very good chance sometime in the near future that you may get a party like Beppe Grillo's Five Star Party, which is sort of it's basically what I call the anti-party, because it's anti-euro, it's anti-this, it's anti-this, I don't know what they're for, but they're basically anti-everything. But if they get into parliament, then they could very easily basically follow through on their policy platform, which is to leave the euro and leave the European Union. So then that's kind of interesting. Then in March, we're going to get the UK supposedly triggering Article 50 and therefore starting the entire Brexit process. And nobody really knows how that's going to all work out. But everybody keeps saying that Theresa May is a bit silly doing it in March. But I happen to think that the timing is perfect, because that's just before the French elections, which is in April, May. And also before the German elections, which will be in the autumn of 2017. And the real issue is that none of us know how these elections will play out. And let me illustrate that with the French election. Now, the best way to describe François Hollande is, as you know, people do this sort of strange graph or strange analysis, which is people in favor of a candidate and people against a candidate, and they do the net to see whether you're popular or unpopular. Now, the strange thing about that is, if you do U.S. presidential candidates, they're actually more unpopular than they are popular, both of them. But the funniest one is in France. They are still about 6 months away from their election, but all their politicians, the negative sentiments outweigh positive sentiments by an even bigger number.
Wow.
Every one of them.
Right.
Which is quite remarkable. And what I think is more likely than not to happen is, they have a strange system where you have a runoff, and unless you get an absolute majority, you have to keep going until somebody gets an absolute majority. In the first round, it's very likely that Marine Le Pen, who runs for the National Front, which is a very far right-wing party, which is a bit similar to the Italian Five Star Party in the sense they're anti-Euro, anti-immigration, and anti-European Union. And there's a very good chance that they will make it into the second round. And if they make it into the second round, the chances are they will run against a center-right candidate, which could be somebody like the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, or another former politician called Alain Juppé. The most interesting thing is going to be that the temptation for that candidate, the center-right candidate, to defuse the appeal of Marine Le Pen is very simple, is to offer a referendum during their term in office on France's membership of the European Union, exactly the same as Brexit. So it's quite conceivable that those elections in France, certainly, and perhaps something similar might happen in Germany, but the chances are lower, will trigger new rounds of instability. And the last one is actually also in the second half of 2017, is the Chinese National Congress. Now, Westerners generally have this picture of China where, you know, basically President Xi is completely in control. And to some extent, the system allows him to be in control. But he's going to actually have to be voted back into power at the Chinese National Congress. And there's quite a lot of infighting going on. And I'll give you a very small example of how limited his power is. He actually is very keen on banning smoking, which in China is very difficult because everybody smokes, in public places. So he made his wife the ambassador for the anti-smoking camp. And interestingly enough, no state or no municipality has agreed with that. So they have basically made exceptions to the rule and effectively undermined what the president wants. So the point I'm making is the assumption that President Xi is all-powerful and able to do things is not clear-cut. And there may be ructions in China as well. So that's not a good combination. So politically, we have all these risks. So we have central bank policy risk, we have political risk, and we have banking systems around the world, which obviously is highlighted by the problems in Italy and to a lesser extent by the problems in Deutsche Bank. So we have this whole set of problems, which for the large part, markets are completely ignoring.
But I guess the question is, you know, when and if is it going to be a breaking point? And it's interesting you mentioned that it is wise for the UK to actually invoke Article 50 and start the process before there's any potential political change, because the other parties could, in fact, create a significant amount of difficulty for them to, in the negotiation of what the process is. It could happen either way, but by doing it ahead of time, it could possibly at least get the current parties to agree on a few things. And depending on how it goes at that point, they're already talking about in the UK of additional stimulus and, you know, more because they, you know, think that there's obviously going to be a bit of a vacuum after this happens. And what's really interesting about that is when I looked at this very closely, I realized, you know, there's not a lot they can do at this point because already the pound is down significantly. It's causing inflationary, very significant inflation to build there. They want to drop the currency even lower to allow for additional benefits for their exporters. And at the same time, that creates inflation. So now all of a sudden, they're going to have a situation where they may have runaway inflation and no way to tame that. That's a real
problem. I think you're right.
That's a real big problem for them.
And I think the problem is certainly that the options are very limited. But I also think people forget that the UK economy has become hollowed out, like many economies, and they don't make anything. So even a lower currency doesn't necessarily improve their position, simply because other than tourism into Britain and a few other areas, it doesn't give them that much of an export boost. And you're quite correct. I remember the actual discussion was about the UK raising rates, not dropping rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's completely reversed. And the new chancellor, which is basically the Treasury Secretary, Philip Hammond, is talking about basically abandoning austerity, which is kind of interesting given that they're running large deficits and also have a large buildup of debt. So their options are very, very limited. This will amuse you. They're trying to do trade deals with places like Australia. And there was a lovely story about the fact that the UK were going to get their way through Brexit by actually exporting more cider and beer to Australia, which I thought was the only way to put it was a kind of a stretch, because if they thought that was going to solve their problems, I think they need a bigger issue. But I don't actually know how this is going to work out. But I just don't think it's going to be a pleasant linear process. And obviously, this has triggered internal problems, like the Scottish may want to basically now leave the United Kingdom and remain a party of the European Union for their own reasons.
All of this, which is fascinating, by the way. And to get back to my earlier point about this general anesthesia that has gripped the world, and when you look at things like, Deutsche Bank has done some, actually, to be very honest with you, there is a lot of real mischief going on in Germany. You know, between the Volkswagen fiasco, between the Deutsche Bank, and a variety of other things. I mean, there, you have to wonder, this is the this is the center of the wealth and of the driver of the economies within Europe. I mean, you know, Germany is supposed to be the strongest, the best, and all this. And we're seeing these kind of things go on. I mean, it's one hit after the next on Deutsche Bank of what they pulled, the shenanigans they pulled over the years. Now, some of the things are, you know, there is a, I think there's a bit of, you know what, you want to tax Apple and have them pay $14 billion? Well, we're going to charge Deutsche Bank $14 billion at this point for something that happened 7 years ago. So there's a bit of a tit for tat going on right now with trying to make sure that the, you know, there isn't any kind of excessive tariffs put on. But there seems to be just a lack of concern for any of the things that we've talked about for some time. One of the things we've talked about is there is helicopter money going on in the United States, which can be defined as simply taking money, maybe borrowing it, and then giving it back to the country's citizenship. Well, that's being done in the corporate sector by share buybacks and, as they call it, shareholder-friendly policies of increasing dividends, et cetera. Where are they getting the money from? Well, we know they're borrowing it and they're buying it back. There's been some companies that have been initiating share buybacks in the amount of 10% to 15%. I think American Express, 15% of the whole entire company, they're buying back within the next year.
Well, I always remember that just before 2008, a number of companies like General Electric and some of the banks bought back large chunks of their shares. And obviously, after the problems of 2008, 2009, they were forced to issue it. And I always was amused to discover that clearly I had been wrong all my life, that I thought basically that you bought low, sold high. Except they'd managed to try to make money by buying high and then selling the shares low to raise more money.
But none of this is going to change. Interesting. None of this is going to change long as interest rates are low and as long as investors are flocking. You see, it all makes sense if you think about it. There's really low interest rates. So what's happening is that companies found out that, well, let's pump our dividends up. That will attract investors for the obvious reasons. And then we could buy back shares and make our EPS look better, even though revenues have been flat for a few years now. And central banks are obviously on this whole bandwagon too, because they understand that if they shift their policy, it's going to affect a lot of other things. It may might not be a direct impact on, let's say, the stock markets itself or on the economy right away itself, but it does have an impact on, you know, other areas. It's going to push on a string somewhere else that's going to possibly cause problems. But again, Das, with all this said, why is it that there is still a major, I mean, we have not been out of this channel, this general channel in the U.S. stock market. Yeah, Japan's doing very poorly. One of the things is that they're a major exporter. Their yen is up, I think, 16 or 18% this year. And what is it that is not being understood, or that maybe what we're talking about maybe isn't as important to investors these days than it should be?
Well, Upton Sinclair once wrote that you can never get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. So investors basically, and everything we've said to lesser or greater extent, everybody knows. We're not talking about anything which is secret. And everybody sort of grits their teeth and looks at this and goes, look, we all know this, but we have to keep going because what's the alternative? And as a result of that, the markets are going to keep going. But we all know, everybody's assuming that when the music stops, they think they're going to find a chair to sit down on. And they're not. It's as simple as that. And I honestly don't know what the trigger is going to be. My sense is it's going to be a policy mistake or a political event. It's not going to be an economic event. And then we'll see what happens. And what I really feel sorry for is actually the ordinary investors in all of this. Because there's a lovely phrase that John Kenneth Galbraith actually used. It was called Beazle. And what Beazle means is somebody robs you, but you don't discover that you've actually been robbed till later. So you think you're actually rich, and then later you discover you've been robbed. And you look at everything they're buying, like corporate bonds, structured securities or whatever, or shares relying on the dividend income, are very sophisticated forms of Beazle. Because essentially you think you're rich because you're getting this income and so forth, but the reality is the hidden risks will ultimately come home to roost. And you just don't know when that's going to occur, and you certainly won't know even when it's occurred. And I'll give you one example of that. We saw two bond issues in emerging markets, which brought tears of laughter to my face.
Venezuela's
one was, sorry?
Venezuela?
Not Venezuela so much. I was thinking of the issue by Argentina, when they issued the large $16.5 billion. And I was sort of shaking my head going, aren't these the people who have defaulted shortly before this?
Shortly and before that.
Exactly. And they defaulted. They're a serial defaulter, let's be honest. They're a serial defaulter.
Right, of course.
And people are rushing that saying what a great deal is. And it's for something like, I can't remember what the coupon was. It was like 5 or 6%.
And I think it was oversubscribed significantly as well.
Oh yeah, and the other one was Saudi Arabia, where they issued I think $17.5 billion, and they could have got $67 billion, and their coupon was closer to 4 something, I think, from memory. And this is a country which is last year ran a current account, sorry, budget deficit of 15%. They're running down their reserves at a rate of an unbelievable amount. They don't have an economy. I mean, basically, Saudi Arabia is a gas station.
The biggest 7-Eleven in the world.
They're the biggest 7-Eleven in the world, and also basically they're in the most unfriendly area of the world that you can actually ever imagine, where everybody hates them. And you know, everybody's going, what a great deal it is. And the only thing they base this on is, I actually saw the offering memorandum, which is quite funny, is they've got this McKinsey plan called Saudi Arabia 2030. And apparently they're going to be the technological capital of the world, the tourist capital of the world, and they're not going to be reliant on oil at all.
Oh, there you go. No, that gives us an answer to that question. You know, you have to pay, I don't know, $3-5 million, maybe $10 million for a nice slide deck. And basically a pitch book to come out and say that in the next 20 years or so, 15 years, we are going to transform what we've had forever and turn the desert into an oasis. And oil is not even a necessity for us to be involved with. I like it. Let's just take a minute and talk about, even though it's not something that you said would be on your side, but let's talk about the U.S. presidential comedy campaign. That's going on here. It's obviously for the rest of the world. I find it amusing. I find it not only amusing, I find it entertaining. And the last several debates, I really did watch, not only to see what was going on from a policy standpoint and try to understand, but which I don't, and I didn't get anything out of it, but also for the entertainment value of it, because it is a level of ridiculousness. And it's very sad as well that this is what it's come down to, that it has to be these barbs are thrown and this uncovering of this data and information, and this one is groping and grabbing, and this one is lying and cheating, and they're name calling, and all this is going on. Yeah, it's always gone on to some degree in presidential elections, but this is every time it comes, I say the same thing. This is the worst ever. But right now it looks like, from the polls that I've seen at least, that Hillary Clinton is looking like a better potential to get the presidency. And the Republicans are going to still have some of the Congress and a majority there. So, but we may have the same thing that we've seen, you know, before. You know, it looks to me like the rest of the world would prefer Clinton than Trump. It looks like here in the U.S., well, clearly in Mexico too, in the U.S., there is a very divided situation. Is there anything that we're missing in terms of we have seen the tax policies, at least plans and outlines from Clinton? Trump has really provided just that it's the best and it's going to be terrific and it's going to be wonderful. Is there anything we're missing here?
I think the fundamental thing is there's actually more similarities to the policies than you actually think. And the crucial thing for the global economy, and certainly for the American economy, is that there's going to be a much greater circling of the wagons and putting up barriers, because both parties are anti-trade, and both parties to different levels are about essentially pulling up the drawbridges and closing off externalities, if you like. Because I think no matter what happens, there will be those internal pressures, which actually will be, to some extent, inevitable. It's been going on for a while, so it's not unusual in that sense. So I think that's the first thing that people need to factor in, is the economy is going to be much more closed than it has been going forward, and that'll have positives and that'll have negatives. The second thing, I think, is if you look at the history of U.S. politics the last 15 years or so, it's been very difficult for the executive to get any piece of legislation through. And they've only succeeded with huge compromises and with basically very, very much damaged pieces of legislation. That's not going to change. Because if nothing else, this election has poisoned the well to the point that the idea of anything which is bipartisan is going to be limited. And I think that's, so nothing's going to happen. There's going to be policy absolute log jams. And the other thing which I think is interesting, and I think this is the only thing I've taken out of the recent sort of press coverage and the statements of the candidates, is whatever happens, the forces underlying somebody like Mr. Trump and underlying somebody like Mr. Sanders, defeated though they might be, aren't going to go away anytime soon.
I agree with that. I agree that there's an underlying swell of a movement of some sort, which is anti-this.
That's right. And that's going to play out. And it may not play out over the next 4 years, but I certainly think it'll play out over the next 10 or 12. And that is going to keep going. And how that plays out, you're much closer to, and you'll see that more than I do.
I'll make it very clear. We've become Europe.
Yep.
We have become Europe and Japan, by the way.
Yes.
From a economic standpoint, we are now creeping and have been for some time, but getting more and more into the Japanese mode. And from a overall, I think, political standpoint, we are now Europe.
You know, one of the funniest things about this is I was reading something which was saying about the merits of different systems and in terms of basically welfare and so forth. And the most amusing thing to me was the writer was basically very critical of Europe and its welfare state and the government's interference in the economy and in the market system. And I was a little sort of bemused, because if you actually look at the world that we now live in, where central banks manipulate interest rates, they manipulate what financial institutions can and can't do, and the government is becoming more and more activist. You know, I think, forget about the United States or Europe or anywhere, most of the world is now moving to a managed economy of some description, and with that managed economy comes repression of different types, both financial, political, and certainly in terms of media. And that's the kind of world we're trying to create, because when you get into these sorts of intractable problems, you can't solve them. You just got to try to bury them.
It's the HMO economy.
Yeah.
That's what it is, right? The HMO economy.
Yeah, that's a very good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, you know, you can go to these doctors, or you can go to, or you know what, we're going to tell you what you could spend on this, or what is approved, or what is not approved, or it's basically that we're living in, as you mentioned, managed, which is maybe we believe that we have full freedom to do whatever we want. Yes, of course, but the entire process from, I'm not only talking about health insurance and healthcare and that, but the economy, all of that, as you mentioned, you know, the HMOs will tell the doctors what they can actually charge for this, what is approved, what isn't approved, what they could do is like what they're doing with the banks. I mean, the banks have become an HMO essentially, and you know, you're not directed to them, but the overlying regulation and legislation over it is become that. It's very sad. So the HMO economy, maybe we'll call that the show title.
I think that's a good title. I think it's a very elegant way of actually explaining what the world is. And I just think it's kind of sad, because the only way we actually have to get out of it is to face up to certain realities and start to address each of the problems. But in the HMO economy, the whole point of the HMO system is that you avoid confronting the actual harsh reality.
Crazy. Well, Das, as always, appreciate you coming on. You can buy his book, of course, over on Amazon or any great bookseller. There's several of them that you want to read. Trust me, they're excellent, excellent reads. The Age of Stagnation is his latest, and we'll have him again on soon. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Andrew.
You're the best. You're the favorite.
That's very kind.
I'll see you soon. Thanks.
See you soon, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. We're going to get some more of your questions, by the way. Next week, we have a number of listener questions. And a few weeks ago, I told you that you can go right over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can ask your questions. As a matter of fact, in the show notes of this episode, We put the area where you can actually ask the questions. If you want to, also you can go to the top navigation bar of thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can find the information there as well. The other thing that you could do, which is really kind of cool on the site, is if you want to search for a particular guest that has been on, or maybe a stock symbol that we talked about, you can go over to the podcast search. There's a link right on the top of the page, and you click that, and you can do a drop down for any of the guests that we've had. You can see what shows they've been on, what they've talked about, and maybe there was more than one guest on any particular show, and the stocks that we talked about on that show, and you can listen right there. It's a pretty cool way to do it and find out maybe some more things about a particular guest that you liked and what they're talking about at any particular time back in time. And again, you can go over and ask me a question. Next week, we're going to answer a listener question. So if you want your question on the show, well, ask a question. It's the best time to do it is now. And we can hopefully get you an answer to what you're thinking about. Now, before we went to talk to Das, I wanted to mention some of the things that are coming up this week. So let's kind of just go through that very, very quickly. So on Monday, we have some earnings, nothing really in the area of economics, but we have earnings from Boise Cascade, Kimberly-Clark, T-Mobile, and Visa. On Tuesday, we have the October Conference Board Consumer Confidence Index and the August Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And returning back to earnings for a moment, we have we're going to be hearing from Apple, AT&T, Capital One, Caterpillar, Chipotle, Eli Lilly, JetBlue, Freeport-McMoRan, General Motors, lots of names here, Pandora, Panera, Procter & Gamble, Sherwin-Williams, and Under Armour as well. Now, on Wednesday, we have new home sales numbers coming out and earnings from Allegiant Air, Biogen, Boeing, Cheesecake Factory, Coca-Cola, Comcast, Garmin, Hilton Worldwide, La Quinta, Netgear, Newmont Mining, Northrop Southern, Northrop Grumman, Penske Automotive, Public Storage, Southwest Airlines, Tesla. And also we have Western Digital that day. Now, on Thursday, we have, of course, the initial claims numbers that have come out on employment and the pending home sales data. That's actually on Thursday. Yep. We're going to see also earnings from Aetna, Google, or Alphabet, as they call them now, Amazon, Amgen, Baidu, Bristol-Myers, Cabela's, Dow Chemical, Expedia, Ford Motor Company, Hanes Brands, LinkedIn, Marathon Petroleum, Nokia, Sirius XM, Twitter, and Virgin America. And on Friday, we're going to see the initial third quarter GDP estimate, as well as the October University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, plus earnings from AutoNation, Chevron, Exelon, ExxonMobil, Hershey, Phillips 66, and Xerox. Now, one of the things I'm going to be looking for next week, I believe it's Tuesday, is the earnings from Groupon, because I've been looking at them recently, and I've seen some things that and some recent reports that look like there is some positive momentum going on with Groupon. I also saw the commercials, which may be nothing to look at in terms of traditional fundamental analysis. But I like what I saw in their commercials. As crazy as it sounds, I've seen this before, by the way. I've seen when companies have a real good advertising campaign and are right on with whether it is the demographics that are maybe buying the products or maybe it's something that people could really grab onto, that the company seemed to do really well. Whether it's a social media campaign, whether it is an email campaign, a television, radio campaign. And I've seen this before where somehow they gain a lot of momentum. Of course, they have to spend a lot of money to do the advertising, the cost of the media, the cost of the production, the advertising companies themselves, et cetera. But I don't know, something about the Groupon situation looked really interesting to me. So take a look at that, just watch it. We'll see how that plays out. I'm very curious to see how that's going to work, if there is a very close tie to how they are really looking for experiential type of deals that hits right to the heart of the largest population right now, the millennials, and if they're grabbing on and doing something with it. And if, in fact, that's going to be helpful to Groupon. because they're more than just restaurants right now. Anyway, I'm not trying to do a commercial for them. I'm just telling you that I think it was really interesting, all the things that I saw with regard to how they're changing their advertising pitch. And we'll see if it works, especially in a stock that a lot of people are really negative on. The shorts are pretty high in there, and there is the potential for it to launch if they do any better. I think they're looking to lose about 2 cents a share, I think it is. And I believe it's $790 million. I believe that was the numbers that I saw of revenue. So take a look at that. That's it. We're going to wrap it up right there. I hope you enjoyed your Sunday football, or maybe the lack of political shows in the afternoon. Take a break from that for a little while. And hopefully you'll listen to also this week. Coming up Tuesday is DH Unplugged with myself and John C. Dvorak. If you have any questions, well, you know where to find me. And thanks for listening. I appreciate it. See you next week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.